From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
One lawmaker wants to let students carry guns on college and university campuses.
The rights that you have across the street from a college campus, you should have on a college campus.
Also this week, a committee of lawmakers is reviewing the $950 million in projects Governor Ron DeSantis vetoed last year.
We'll prepare a list of these eight projects that will be recommended to the Speaker's office for additional review.
Florida's insurer of last resort, Citizens Property Insurance, is raising its rates. And for some, it could be a good thing.
Every type of policy written in the state of Florida could see a multi-year assessment, which we fondly call the hurricane tax. We don't want to see that scenario.
I'm Regan McCarthy. This is Capitol Report. Should Florida college students be allowed to carry guns on campus? One lawmaker says yes. Adrian Andrews reports on how students are reacting to the proposal.
Melbourne Republican Senator Randy Fine says students should be able to protect themselves. He feels that became even clearer after he saw how schools responded in 2023 to the Hamas-Israel war in Gaza.
Many universities around the country focus on protecting Muslim terrorists and not their own students. I believe these students have the right to protect themselves. This will make sure they have that right.
Fine's bill would extend concealed carry rights onto the campuses of state colleges and universities. Under the rules, guns would be allowed throughout campus, including dorms.
I don't think your Second Amendment rights go on vacation because you're coming onto college campus.
Abigail Young, a junior at Florida State University, says the thought of her classmates having guns during an on-campus emergency is scary.
College campus police would address it far better than a college-age student, and probably with far more accuracy and regard for safety.
Florida A&M University sophomore Kadri Latiker says he understands why some people might want to bring a gun on campus, but he says that doesn't mean he will feel safer having them around.
If someone truly feels like they need protection, I don't see the issue with the actual law itself, but just on a college campus with a lot of students present, I just don't see where that could have many favorable outcomes.
Fine's measure does include a carve-out for sporting events. According to the bill's text, Florida colleges and universities can have so-called safe zones around campus during athletic events in which firearms would not be allowed. But in order for schools to have a gun-free zone, they must submit a security plan and be cleared by the Department of Law Enforcement. Fine says the measure is about protecting Second Amendment rights.
The fact of the matter is the rights that you have across the street from a college campus, you should have on a college campus.
The bill is one of several in the works this session to loosen restrictions on firearms. Palm Bay Republican Representative Monique Miller recently introduced legislation to ban the use of artificial intelligence to detect firearms in public areas. And she's currently drafting a bill that would allow anyone in Florida to openly carry firearms. Meanwhile, Fine says he's putting his support behind a plan to drop the state's minimum purchasing rifle age from 21 to 18.
I filed two gun bills, and I'm leaving fairly early in the session. I think open carry is a pretty spirited discussion to have. If it comes up while I'm still there, I'd vote for it.
The measures have the backing of some political heavyweights, including Governor Ron DeSantis, who has spoken in favor of an open carry policy. But some lawmakers, including Senate President Ben Albritton, have voiced hesitancy on that measure, pointing to concerns from law enforcement. I'm Adrian Andrews.
While Florida lawmakers and Governor Ron DeSantis have seemingly buried the hatchet in their immigration fight, legislative leaders aren't done pushing back against DeSantis. Tristan Wood reports lawmakers have been meeting over the last few weeks to decide which of the governor's 2024 budget vetoes to override.
After lawmakers voted during a special session last month to override a couple of the governor's 2024 line item budget vetoes, House Speaker Daniel Perez formed four work groups to reconsider the $950 million worth of projects the governor cut. Several of the groups already have their recommendations ready to go. One committee is recommending 22 of the 160 vetoed water infrastructure projects should receive funding. Lakewood Ranch Republican Representative Bill Connerly says the projects will have a sweeping impact across the state.
This looks like a civil engineer's wish list, like what they would wish for Christmas. So all of these projects are very good, and the geographic span of it and the types of projects. We have septic to sewer projects. We have a membrane bioreactor project, a high service pump for frostproof water treatment. It's just a very broad, both geographically and the type of projects and the benefits.
8 of the 60 vetoed human services projects have also been recommended for funding. In those work groups, lawmakers selected a set number of projects they believe deserved reconsideration, then discussed them over several meetings. But as Miami Republican Representative Mike Redondo points out, the work groups are just submitting recommendations.
We'll prepare a list of these 8 projects that will be recommended to the Speaker's office for additional review. And again, they have the discretion at that point to accept, reject, modify, whatever they may want to do. But I do think that this has been a productive process for us.
But Escambia Republican Representative Michelle Salzman, who managed one of the work groups, says legislative leaders have been hands-off so far in the process.
Speaker Perez had no recommendations, no input at all. He didn't come to me, call me, ask me what was happening. He really empowered each of you to make the right decisions and for us as a body to come up with this process on our own.
One of the most publicized parts of DeSantis's vetoes was his decision to spike every allocation for arts and culture projects. The library's Cultural and Historical Preservation Work Group recommended revoking vetoes on 6 projects. One of them is the Florida Black Music Legacy Exhibit at Wellsbilt Museum of African American History and Culture in Orange County. Several lawmakers, including Fort Lauderdale Democratic Representative Daryl Campbell, wants that funding reconsidered because it was championed by Senator Geraldine Thompson, who passed away this month.
For her, gospel was also something that she lived day in and day out. Sometimes you can hear her humming and singing some gospel tunes. But having had the pleasure to work with her in the honor, I think this project right here would be something that her community can utilize and reflect on as they mourn a loss of a giant in their community.
The Speaker's office will decide which of the projects will make it in the final package of proposed veto overrides. From there, a supermajority in the House and Senate, or 2/3 of lawmakers, will have to vote to override DeSantis's veto for it to happen. I'm Tristan Wood.
Citizens Property Insurance, Florida's insurer of last resort, is raising rates more than 8% for 80% of its policyholders. Governor Ron DeSantis says it's necessary to save the state's struggling insurance market. WGCU's Sandra Victorova spoke with Mark Freelander of the Insurance Information Institute about why this may be a good move for policyholders of other types of coverage.
Citizens is the state-backed insurer of last resort, which was created by the Florida legislature to act as a backstop for those consumers that cannot find coverage in the private market.
So why do you think Citizens continuing to increase its rates is a positive thing for Florida homeowners in general?
Citizens grew at an extremely high rate for several years because of Florida's man-made risk crisis of legal system abuse and assignment of benefits claim fraud. In fact, at year-end 2023, Citizens had 18.5% market share, by far the largest home insurer in the state of Florida. You never want your backstop insurer to be your largest market. And there are several reasons for that. Citizens has been selling insurance at a discounted rate. And that is mandated by the state regulations. They don't allow Citizens to charge what we call actuarial sound rates. So as a result, Citizens typically will always be the best price any consumer could get. And Citizens is not intended to be a lifetime insurer, only a backstop when there's no other options. Well, now that the private market has improved substantially, it's time to get customers off of Citizens. And they've been going through a very extensive depopulation program, moving several hundred thousand customers to the private market. It's because the private market's financial position has improved. They're able to take on more risk exposure. But in order for that depopulation to continue in a positive fashion, Citizens needs to have unattractive rates. So Citizens needs to raise the rates and no longer compete with the private market. That is the goal of the rate changes that we're talking about today.
When Citizens gets too big, what is the risk to all of us?
We have the potential of what's called a hurricane tax, which is a surcharge that could be applied not only to all existing Citizens customers, but an emergency assessment to every consumer in the state of Florida. And we're not just talking about homeowners. We're talking about renters, those that have a renter's insurance policy, talking about auto insurance policies, pet insurance policies, life insurance policies. Every type of policy written in the state of Florida could see a multi-year assessment, which we fondly call the hurricane tax. We don't want to see that scenario. Citizens is doing a great job depopulating, and it needs to continue to come down. A few hundred thousand more customers need to be moved to the private market over the next couple of years to get to a stable position. Because in order for Florida to have a stable marketplace statewide, we need Citizens to be a much smaller risk exposure. Florida consumers have been paying higher rates because of the man-made risk crisis once again. Billboard attorneys drove this crisis. They took advantage of loopholes in Florida regulations to sue insurers at historical levels. In fact, 4 out of every 5 property claim lawsuits in the U.S. for many years were filed in Florida. That's a disproportionate level. Now, some attorneys might tell you insurers need to be sued to pay claims, but it was an extreme level. We're talking about 80 to 100,000 lawsuits a year in Florida for several years. Completely an out-of-control situation that the legislature finally addressed in December 2022. We already had seen 6 Florida insurers go insolvent.
Is there still more that needs to be done? And do you expect rates to turn around here for homeowners soon?
Rates have moderated in Florida. Florida had the lowest average rate changes in the U.S. last year. We don't expect the legislature to pass any bills that would upset the current dynamics where the market is vastly improving.
That was Mark Freelander of the Insurance Information Institute, an industry association, speaking with WGCU's Sandra Victorova. Legislation from Republican Senator Keith Trunau would ban water fluoridation statewide. Central Florida Public Media's Molly Durig reports.
At least 15 water systems in Florida recently ended the long-recommended public health practice of fluoridating drinking water for cavity prevention. All but one of those decisions came after late November, when Florida Surgeon General Joseph Latipo called water fluoridation, quote, public health malpractice, end quote, in light of some recent studies and a federal court ruling. Now, Trunau is proposing legislation that would ban the use of certain additives in public water systems statewide, including additives primarily for health-related purposes. The language is embedded within a larger agriculture bill. I'm Molly Durig.
Still to come on Capitol Report. We'll hear about an effort to support Everglades restoration and flood planning. One lawmaker calls it a great opportunity.
For our continued mission with South Florida, with the governor, and with the federal partnership that we have with the Army Corps of Engineers to make sure that we have our commitment to the Everglades front and center.
A Florida State University professor talks about AI in education. Turns out it's about a lot more than worrying about whether students are cheating on tests.
What I always say to people when people ask me about academic integrity is that there are 100 things that terrify me about AI, and cheating is not one of them.
And we'll hear from a former First Lady of Florida A&M University about helping to pave the way for future students. The State Environmental and Natural Resources Committee has advanced a bill to offer $750 million to Everglades restoration. Josh Holton reports the bill's supporters also want to see smarter spending and more transparency in how water management districts operate.
Republican State Senator Jason Broder sponsored the bill and hailed it as offering historic support for Everglades restoration and flood planning.
A great opportunity for us to return to the core mission of flood control and have some real spending oversight for our continued mission, both with South Florida, with the governor, and with the federal partnership that we have with the Army Corps of Engineers to make sure that we have our commitment to the Everglades front and center.
Districts will now be allowed to hold referendums on levying property taxes for water supply projects, as well as water quality and flood protection efforts. Broder said this offers Floridians a, quote, stronger voice to decide whether or not to increase their taxes to finance the construction of capital improvement projects, unquote. But he said property taxes won't be the only way districts can pursue funding.
The way that the water management districts are funded, either through the state or a federal partnership, is one of the avenues that they have. They also have taxing authority now. It's part of your TRIM notice that you see that the water management districts assess a slight fee there.
TRIM notices refer to truth in millage, meaning taxpayers can find out how much they owe in taxes and to which governmental taxing authority. The property appraiser sends this information to the property owner through what's called a TRIM notice. The bill also creates a loan fund to help districts afford flooding and sea level rise resiliency project costs. Money for the fund will come from a gambling deal with the Seminole Tribe. The deal was made in exchange for allowing the tribe to offer online sports betting statewide and provide games such as craps at its casinos. The water management bill advanced favorably with unanimous support from the Environment and Natural Resources Committee. I'm Josh Holton.
Artificial intelligence in education is getting widespread attention in K-12 schools as well as higher ed. Gina Jordan talked about the use of AI with Paul Marty via Zoom. He's a professor of information and the associate vice provost for academic innovation at Florida State University.
I would say this to our students all the time. They come in saying, what's the technology skill I need to learn? And I say, it doesn't matter. A, those technology skills are going to change within 5 years. B, those technology skills are increasingly being outsourced to either other people or to AI. It's not your tech skills that matter. It's your people skills, right? Your leadership skills, your management skills. That's what's going to get you your career. So what we're trying to do is help our students develop an innovation mindset. In fact, that's a lot of what we're doing with the Innovation Hub. I work very closely with the folks at the Innovation Hub. We have a lot of programs for faculty and students at the Innovation Hub. All the stuff that we do at the Hub with design thinking and emerging technologies and design sprints and all the extracurricular activities that are designed around helping students learn how to solve problems with different methodologies and different technologies, that's all about shaping the future of education. And AI is just the latest step in that technological progression. So we've been doing this for a very, very long time. And it requires change, and change is hard, but we can do change. I mean, we really are moving into a world where what matters is that human-human connection. What matters is the thing that AI can't do. So when we talk to faculty about, well, how are we changing our courses? How are we changing the way I teach? Right? It all comes down to enabling our students to actually solve problems in a way that the computers can't.
I mean, really more than ever, if you're relying on AI, you have to be able to think critically because, as we know, ChatGPT is not perfect. Just as an example.
Well, of course, I should point out humans aren't perfect either, right? And what matters more than anything is our critical thinking skills. We've always needed to have our own ability to assess the quality of information sources, and we're no good at doing that. So I have a long, probably 30-year-old soapbox lecture about how we need to start teaching kids from kindergarten up how to assess the quality of information sources, how to determine whether or not something is true or not. We've never been good at doing that, and we have to figure out a way to get good at that as we move forward. And AI is just further exacerbating that particular problem. And you know what's not as important is being the one person who knows the answer to something, because that's no longer the world in which we live. Anybody with an internet connection can find the answer to the question. The real question is, what do you do with it? How do you apply it?
Yeah. So how would you say students can benefit from AI while also staying within the confines of the academic honor policy?
Right. So, I mean, what I always say to people when people ask me about academic integrity is that there are 100 things that terrify me about AI, and cheating is not one of them. Students will always find a way to cheat if they want to find a way to cheat, right? There's nothing new here at all. In fact, there's a lot of positives that have come out from students having access to AI tools. The number one positive is that we put a lot of those essay mills out of business. You know about that, right? People used to be able to pay someone $1,000 to write an essay for them that would pass a plagiarism detection, right? The real problem with that, and you know, people knew about those essay mills, but one of the things that people often didn't know is that oftentimes those essay mills were fronts for blackmailing services, right? So you got your essay, it successfully passed the plagiarism test, you got the grade for the assignment of the class, and a month later, you got an email from the company threatening to expose you to your university unless you paid up.
That's kind of brilliant.
Yeah, it was a lot of money was being made there. A lot of money was being there, very illegally and unethically behind the scenes, right? And so, and again, that's another disruption, another change that has happened. Again, what it comes down to me is this is an opportunity for us to raise the bar. This is an opportunity for us to ask our students to do things that computers cannot do, and rethinking the way we teach our classes, right? Look at how high schools are teaching math. I'm just thinking about this because my younger son's a high school student, right? He's got great math teachers, right? You know, they always say, you know, use whatever tools you want to use when you're trying to understand the problem, right? There's a lot of great AI tools out there that will explain math to you. It will walk you through the problems, help you solve the problems step by step by step by step. There's never an excuse for you to be sitting home trying to do homework and trying to figure out how to solve this problem when there are all these tools out there can explain it to you. But the important thing is understanding the difference between just copying the answer that the computer gives you and using the computer as like a personal tutor to help you understand it. Because when push comes to shove, when you sit down at that math test, the AI is not going to be there to help you. So did you actually understand it is the only thing that matters. So if we think about a positive use of AI in that situation, the AI can be the non-person, right? The artificial person that's there as your tutor to explain the problem to you. You're stuck, ask the AI, it'll give you the answer, it'll help you figure out what you need to do to move forward. But it's the student's responsibility to know how to do that in a way that actually improves their own knowledge so that they can do it on their own when they take the test.
That was Paul Marty, a professor and associate vice provost for academic innovation at FSU, talking AI in education. The Florida Senate has released a 129-page bill that would take steps to bolster healthcare, education, roads, and economic development in 31 counties that, in many cases, have not experienced the same booming growth as other parts of Florida. The legislation, championed by Tallahassee Republican Senator Corey Simon, seeks to help financially struggling rural hospitals and attract doctors and other healthcare providers to rural areas. It would also provide incentives for teachers to work in rural areas, boost state spending on roads, and help with other infrastructure improvements. Senate President Ben Albritton, a citrus grower, hopes the bill will kickstart the economy of rural Florida.
The reason there's not economic development in rural Florida is that they don't have resources, and they don't have resources because they don't have any economic development.
The bill is filed for the legislative session that will start March 4th. And with Florida preparing next year to mark the 250th anniversary of the 1776 signing of the Declaration of Independence, Governor Ron DeSantis has helped unveil a bronze statue of George Washington in the state capitol. The statue is on loan from the Mount Vernon Ladies Association. DeSantis hopes Washington's statue will help spark interest in the nation's 250th anniversary.
Washington's virtue is something that we should study and we should honor, because at every moment he put the viability of the republic and the good of the people over his personal desire for power.
As part of his $115.6 billion budget proposal for the upcoming fiscal year, DeSantis included $1 million in cultural and museum grants for projects related to the 250th anniversary. The statue will be in the state capitol for the next year. You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Regan McCarthy. Finally this week. This Black History Month, WUSF is reporting the stories of important local Floridians. Today, we hear from Geraldine Williams. She's from Ybor City, she's a lawyer, a journalist, and she's the former First Lady of Florida A&M University.
It was scary. It was scary because here I am in Florida, and to the west of me was Mississippi, where when they tried to integrate there, two people were killed. And then over in Georgia, the governor had the axe handled, and he was against integration. And then in Jacksonville, when some black students were brought in from, I think, Carolina, to integrate the pools, swimming pools, at the motels and hotels, the manager of one of them went around and poured acid in the hotel pool while they were in there. I didn't feel very comfortable. Over time, my anxieties were altered. I looked for what was positive. There could have been a lot negative, but what I know is that I felt safe on the campus. When I married Walter Smith, he was not Dr. Smith, and I sat down with him and I explained the law of the land for the family. I said, now you're going to have to make your choice. You got to be the top of whatever area you choose, but you got to choose one and you got to be the tops. And he decided that he would get his PhD. Then he was named president at Florida A&M University in Tallahassee. I was really excited about that. And I was really very young. I might have been 30 years old. And so I was the youngest First Lady on the campus. I had to figure out what my role was. One of the things that I thought was important was for me to be a role model for those who were following me. And so how could I do that? What would I do? And I looked at the fact that I had my bachelor's degree, I had my MBA, so let me see, what am I going to do? And so I decided to go to law school. And I thought that that was a stepping stone in a direction of showing the young ladies who were coming behind me that they too could do it. Eventually, I was elected president of the Tallahassee Barristers, that's the Black Lawyers Group, and I asked them to authorize me to adopt 20 black boys. And they said, now, wait a minute. Now, we can go along with you with something, and that's a lot. They didn't know that I also had negotiated with the FAMU ROTC to give 20 cadets so that each of those boys could have his own buddy. And so for a semester, I planned a program. I went out and I begged. I didn't know I could beg so well, but I begged up the money for a bus to pick the boys up every week at their school, and they would have to wear their T-shirts. It was G-U-T-S, guts. They had to have guts to be in this program. And they were what you would call the least likely to succeed. But they were excited about wearing their T-shirts and then going and getting on the bus. And I said, and the bus has to drop them off to the mamas. They could not drop them off on the corner. They could not drop them off at the playground to the mamas. So that cost some money. And of the 20, 19 finished the program. I thought that was a pretty high rate of success. That was my beginning with working with children.
That was Geraldine Williams sharing her story with WUSF. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Adrian Andrews, Tristan Wood, Gina Jordan, and Margie Menzel. Thanks also to reporters from Florida public radio stations around the state. Technical assistance for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox. I'm Regan McCarthy. Join us next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.